Mr. Rhodes is the president and CEO of William R. Rhodes Global Advisors. He's had a long and distinguished career with Citibank and Citigroup, starting in 1957. He continued until 2010, when he retired as senior vice chairman. Mr. Rhodes' broad areas of expertise cover Latin America, South America, and the Caribbean. He oversaw Citigroup's operations in those countries for many years. He's been a longtime observer as well, the Asia-Pacific region, with a particular focus on Korea and China. He remains a valuable resource for and confidant of government leaders, policymakers, and executives around the world. Mr. Rhodes is a member of the Group of 30, Council on Foreign Relations, the Economic Club of New York, and if I might say most importantly, he's a senior fellow at Hudson Institute. He is a life trustee at New York Presbyterian Hospital, where he established the William Rhodes and Louise Tilzer Rhodes Center for Glioblastoma. A graduate of Brown University, Mr. Rhodes has remained a major supporter of his alma mater and served as a professor there. Joining Mr. Rhodes will be Hudson's chief operating officer, John Walters. Many of you here know John, and those of you who know him know that there are few people who are more instrumental in Hudson's success and day-to-day operations than John is. He's been a veteran of three U.S. Presidential administrations, getting his start serving as chief of staff to Bill Bennett, then education secretary in the Reagan administration, and moving on to help Bill set up the Office of National Drug Control Policy in the administration of President George H.W. Bush. He would go on to be the director of that agency and serve in the cabinet in the administration of President George W. Bush. Could go on about John's long resume, but I will just say that if that congresswoman from New York I referenced earlier was in high school and college while John was drug czar, maybe she'd have a little bit better understanding of economics when drug use actually went down as opposed to after he left office. So without further ado, I'd like to invite John Walters and Bill Rhodes up front.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt. Thank you all for being here. Most of all, I want to thank Bill, who's been kind enough to help us get some understanding of some of the specifics in a global economic environment that's almost as crazy as the political environment in Washington. Not quite, but almost. So we spoke earlier, and I thought I'd start off by just asking him to talk about kind of some of the trends, but we want to then begin with China and what's happening there. So Bill, kind of help us get a sense of the context here in the current global economy and then the obvious importance of the issues we have with China.
Well, I think the issues we have with China are crucial to where the world economy is going to go over the next few years. People tend to forget that in the Great Recession, it was China spending almost $1 trillion in public works and stuff that helped the world avoid a Great Depression. However, they have built up so much debt to GDP over 300%, and a lot of that's gone into the state-owned enterprises, government-owned, inefficient municipalities, provinces, which have not used the money properly in many ways. And then you have the problems with the shadow banking system, which the government allowed to get away from its control from the major state-owned banks. And a lot of bad loans were made, particularly in northeast China. But this has proved to be a real problem for Xi Jinping as president, and Wang Qishan, who's his reformer vice president, who was before that, Wang Qishan had been in the previous administration, had been the vice premier of finance. So on the one hand, We have Xi Jinping facing this problem of needing to adjust the economy, but also since he sort of declared himself the 19th Party Congress to be the leader forever going forward, he knew that he had to be very careful about slowing down the economy. So they're caught in betwixt and between because the reformers in the government, people like the head of the People's Bank of China, the former head, Zhou Xiaoxuan, the present head, Yi Gang, and a number of others, even Wang Qishan, the vice president, know that these reforms have to take place. And in order for them to take place, that means slowing growth. And so I think that China is in a difficult position today. The trade issue has been hanging in for many administrations, and the whole theft of intellectual property, which we've seen, which comes in many ways through forced mergers in the sense of when you want to operate in China for many, many years, you either had to, if you set up your own operation, a foreign company, you had to take in a Chinese partner, or they merged you in with somebody. And the main reason they did that was get their hands on the intellectual property. And this not just doesn't only cover technology and their plan for 2025, but also even in the financial area. This is something that I had to combat when I was expanding us into throughout China. And so all these things have built up with China. In addition to that, and I think one of the very excellent efforts of the many of the Hudson Institute was with the vice president when he gave that speech about the concerns on China. And it just happened that he had given that speech, and 2 weeks later I was in China at the behest of the head of the People's Bank of China to talk about culture and conduct, a study I did for the Group of 30, basically saying the banks have to learn from all their mistakes of having a bad culture and not having the proper conduct, which helped us get into the Great Recession. And he lined up all the heads of the major banks because they are very concerned about the banking system themselves. But it was interesting, that speech resonated in China, without a doubt. And so we tend to focus on the trade situation. But that speech actually resonated because it covered not only the area of economics, intellectual property, but covered very much the strategic political ambitions of China, not only in the Pacific area, but in the One Belt, One Road, Silk Road plan, which has been expanding worldwide. And so I view it as having put a marker down with China. And so on the one hand, the Chinese know they have to reform the economy because the former governor of the head of the People's Bank of China, Zhou Xiaoxuan, at the 19th Party Congress, and it took a lot of guts for him to say it, gave a press conference as they anointed Xi Jinping, and he got away with it because, number one, he was leaving office, and number two, he's a princeling, and his father and Xi Jinping's father were very close. And that means a lot in China because we have expertise around this room in China. And he gave a press conference, and he said, we have to be very careful in China that we don't have a Minsky moment. And for those of you who are not economists around the room, a Minsky moment means that you suddenly find your economy blowing up by the bad practices and building up debt. And so there's a battle going on right within China today among the reformers, I've mentioned several of them, and those old hardliners that, when I say old hardliners, it's not age in this sense, it's a matter of how they think, who basically don't want to change the system. They want the state control, and as you see, the control on the whole area of privacy, what's going on there, the control of the internet, all of that, but also keeping the state-owned enterprises going. And the great reformer in China was Zhu Rongji some 25 years ago when the banking system was in trouble. He took the opportunity not only to reform the banking system, But he also took the opportunity to start closing the state-owned enterprises. And a lot of these people today who are reformers were really mentees of his, including Wang Qishan, because his view of China was that China needed to open up to the world a lot more rapidly. And although many people feel that Zhu Rongji took the U.S. and the advanced economies to the cleaners when they entered WTO, that was his job. But his view was much different. If he had continued on, you would have had China opening up much more rapidly because that was his vision. Unfortunately, people who followed him didn't have that, vision. And the real question now, I think, of the leadership is how much control they want to give up in turning the economy around. So enter, I mentioned, the vice president's speech, which he gave at the Hudson Institute. And then comes along our own president, President Trump, who's always had a thing about China. For those of us who've known him over time, and there are several of you in the room who have, about the Chinese trade deficit and others. My feeling when I was in China, and this was just before Christmas is when I came back after having spent a week there with a lot of senior leadership and financial, particularly financial leadership, they want a trade deal with us. They cannot afford with this stage that I've outlined here not to have a trade deal because this would hit them a lot worse than us. And so they are making every effort, I think, within their ability, which when I say their ability, their desire to keep political control, to do a trade deal. So I'm optimistic on that. We'll get a deal by March 1st when the president has threatened to extend the $200 billion in tariffs from 10 to 25%. Not clear to me. But the trade side is the easiest part of it. I think the more difficult part is twofold. The intellectual property point, China 2025. Because they have to stop these practices that they have, of forcing companies that have operations, their foreign companies, to give up all their technology. And then, of course, the theft we see that goes up, the whole Huawei situation that we see now in Europe, the arrest of the founder's daughter in Canada, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, for the Iran, going around the Iran sanctions. But I think that's one side of it. The other side that we've got to be very careful about, and I know Lighthizer and others who are negotiating this are concerned, is enforcement. Because it's one thing to agree to something, it's another thing to live up to it. And so we have to have mechanisms on enforcement, which are easier said than done. And so if you look at China today, the economy's slowing down. The central bank is pumping in as much money as they can to the banking system through dropping reserve requirements and other situations, providing short-term money. But the Chinese economy will have a very difficult time of even getting to 6% this year. They ended up at 6.5%. A lot of people doubt their statistics to start off with, including the present premier of China once said when he was a provincial governor in Liaoning province some 10 years ago that the only statistic he believed in was the use of electricity in the country. Of course, he's now premier, Li Qiaocheng, and he doesn't like to be reminded of that. So I think there are two things going here with China. One, to have China grow slow as the second largest economy is concerned for the whole world. On the other hand, they have to be forced to live by the rules of the game because that was part of the understanding when they entered WTO. And so I think I am optimistic that they will be willing at the end of the day to do a lot of the stuff, but I'm not assured, particularly on enforcement and on intellectual property. And then you have the whole dynamic that the vice president picked up on, which is the growth of the Chinese military, which concerns the Japanese tremendously. And Japan has tremendous investments, as does Korea. And we had the head of the Korea Society here, Tom Byrne, who knows this area very well. And Korea's caught in betwixt and between because they are so close to China and they have a history where either the Chinese or Japanese basically have dominated Korea. And it's a very difficult situation. I won't even get into Kim Jong-un, but that is another situation between China and the United States. And it's not clear how that's going to work out. And the only thing I'll say about that, and I think Tom may agree with me on this, is that Kim Jong-un doesn't have much respect for his father. But the one he does respect is Kim Il-sung, his grandfather. In fact, he even kind of dresses and looks like his grandfather, because his grandfather was the expert on being able to play off Stalin and Mao, and was able to get their support at the time of the Korean War. And so I think we have a real difficult situation in with China on Korea, and it's not clear to me how it'll work out, because you have a president of Korea today who has staked his sort of abilities on getting a deal between North and the South. I've known him for a long time when he was President Ngo's chief of staff. And I'm very concerned that he's too overly optimistic and too willing to do what's necessary to do that. So those are areas I think we have to think about. But China slowing down, and the other thing I would just say briefly is on Europe, at the same time China is slowing down and Asia is slowing down, we also see what's going on in Europe. I mean, we have Brexit, 29th of March. Nobody knows what's going to happen. I don't even think Theresa May knows what's going to happen, or the senior bureaucrats in Brussels. You have the Irish question that's been sitting there unresolved, and I like to say that the English have never learned how to deal with Ireland since the Battle of the Boyne, which was, I think, 1684 or 5. They've always managed to treat the Irish badly and never understand them, and that's still there. And then you have real problems in mainland Europe. Macron, who was supposed to have been the person that everyone looked to take over the leadership from Merkel, is in real trouble in France. Spain, it looks like the government of Sanchez, who's a minority socialist government, could be out over the next few months over the situation of Catalonia. Germany is slowing down tremendously, and that had been the great engine of Europe. And it looks like their growth could drop this year to 1%, which is, you know, really, if you take a look at where German growth has been, it's just incredible under Merkel that they would slow down, because they've been the motor. And, of course, I save last but least, and it's not least, but I save last because they view themselves in the Eurozone as least, is Italy. Italy is in a technical recession now. They've had two negative quarters. If you take a look at where the Italian economy was before the entrance to the Eurozone, it is the only major country in the Eurozone whose economy basically has not grown in the sense of real terms since they entered the Eurozone. And you have two parties who are populist parties there who basically want to take on the Eurozone. And you have relations now where the ambassadors between France and Italy are basically being recalled. That hasn't happened since World War II, when Mussolini invaded France, when the Germans had invaded. So there are real problems, I think, within the Eurozone. You know, we used to think Greece was a problem 5, 6, 7 years ago. That's nothing compared to what they're facing today. And the person who's kind of held this together, one was Merkel, and her popularity rating, because she opened the Pandora's box with immigration, has dropped substantially. The far right has gained from 1% of the vote to 13% of the vote. The other person who held together was Mario Draghi, who is the outgoing head of the European Central Bank. And there's no doubt that his policies during the Great Recession and then afterwards during the European debt crisis helped keep the place together. He's leaving. But there's no ammunition in the gun there, because you still have negative interest rates. They just stopped the quantitative easing. And so if you get into a very difficult period in 2020, which I think we're going to face worldwide, they have no ammunition. Because what are they going to do? They already have negative interest rates, and they just stopped the quantitative easing, but you have the book built up there. At least here in the United States, the Fed has been reducing the book from 4.8 trillion. They've got it down now little by little, and they've raised interest rates to a point. And so at least we have some ammunition if we get into a recession in 2020, which a lot of people are predicting. And we're not an island unto ourselves. So if you have problems with growth in Asia and you have problems of growth in Europe, it's bound to affect us one way or the other. And that's my concern. So the Fed is really in a very tight and difficult situation. I was very surprised that Powell made such a tremendous U-turn after rates were raised in December, because he was optimistically talking about raising rates 2-3 more times this year. And I don't think they were taking into account what was going on in the rest of the world. People say that he changed when he gave his forecast, that they were going to pause and look at data and not do anything. I think, among other things, apart from the market reaction, he was not looking carefully enough at what's going on in Asia, particularly China or Europe. And I think they are suddenly concerned about that. Here in the U.S. economy, we basically, the fourth quarter may not have been the greatest, but we had a very good year. I think a lot of volatility. I think we're going to see that volatility continue this year. And I think it's going to be very difficult, unless these situations are turned around, that I've mentioned in Asia, particularly China, and in Europe, for us to have anywhere near more than 2.5% growth this year. And that's lucky. I mean, we have the tax reform and all of that, and a lot of deregulation that's been put through. But I think it's going to be very, very difficult. And so we're in the longest period of post-recession growth in modern history in the United States. And I think it's going to be very difficult, given these other scenarios, to keep that next year.
But am I correct in saying, in assuming from your comments, that you see the United States as the strongest of the major economies when you look at Europe and China?
Without a doubt. I mean, obviously, China, people say, well, look, China's growing at 6.5%. Well, they won't be growing at 6.5% this year. They're lucky they can clear 6%. And some of that data is very suspicious. But you have to remember that China was doing double-digit growth for 15, 20 years. They had growth at one point up to 12, 13%. So when you take it down to this, that has a real impact on the world and on China. And that's what people don't understand. And this is something that Xi Jinping, even though he's anointed leader for life, he still has to keep the population happy. And you have a much greater middle class in China than existed in the days of Zhu Rongji back 25, 30 years ago. And John Zemin.
You mentioned some of the structural changes you think have to be done in passing there. Do you think China can make these structural changes and maintain the regime?
That is a big question, because there's no doubt that the reformers are pushing very hard. In fact, one of the senior reformers told me, he said, Bill, he said, you think when you see these statements that all these meetings come out with a great consensus? He said they really don't. He said there's a real battle going on with the senior management, if you want to say, of China on these issues. And I gave the example of the Minsky moment of Zhou Xiaoshuan, his comments there. I think this is going to be a real difficult situation. And then you go into the trade deal. They need a trade deal. The question is what it's going to be like, and as I said, intellectual property and enforcement. And I think that's what Lighthizer and his people are very concerned about. Those two areas, and they should be concerned. But China needs a trade deal, because they cannot afford, forget about, going from 10% to 25% on $200 billion, of our imports from China. I think it goes beyond that. And one of the concerns many people have is that we're going to see international trade slow down. I even heard one person, who distinguished individual, tell me with what's going on between China and the United States, this distinguished person you all know well, but obviously I'm not going to mention his name, feels that we could be on the edge of 1914. the sleepwalkers, in the sense where you take the world up to 1914. It was the greatest growth, in the economy, the greatest growth in trade, the greatest growth in innovation, technology, health care, everything. And the politicians screwed it up. And they're concerned that if you don't get something worked out between the United States and China, and I haven't even mentioned Mr. Putin here yet, which I want to do because I asked if I could say a word on before you close it off on Venezuela. Because I lived 13 years in Venezuela, and a lot is, and we have experts here, not only in Venezuela, but also on Brazil. And you have the opposite poles going on in those two countries. And in Venezuela, Chavez started this so-called socialist revolution, which was supposed to take the people of Venezuela to untold heights in the sense of health care and education, et cetera, et cetera. What happened starting and he was fortified by a high price of oil and gas, so he was able to do it, is that he wasn't able to accomplish it, and then he died. I guess you can say he probably died at the right moment for his, at that moment, because I don't know what he would have done afterwards. And Maduro took over. And what you've seen is a systematic destruction of the economy of Venezuela, because it is very oil dependent. Their production only 10, 15 years ago was up to almost 4 million barrels a day. Today, with all the incompetence and corruption, it's probably less than 1 million barrels a day. They've tied themselves up with the Chinese and more recently with Putin, with Rosneft. And I know that what's going on there, and I wrote this op-ed, and there are copies on the way out, with Christina Valencia, who's sitting here, who's an expert in humanitarian health care aid, having worked with Doctors Without Borders and the CDC, to try and see what can be done in this area. That's why we collaborated on this article, which Ken Weinstein just mentioned to me. He's now put on your website, because I feel so strong, and I was on Fox TV Friday night talking about it. I mean, we haven't seen a humanitarian crisis in the Western Hemisphere like this in memory. It's worse than what happened in Haiti, because in Haiti, although they went through this difficult period with the earthquake, they allowed international aid agencies to send in, to send in medicines and food and stuff. Maduro refuses to do it. You have 3 million Venezuelans, a tenth of the population, are outside the country, and another 2 million will leave this year. And this country had the best healthcare system in Latin America. It is now the worst. And what's gone on there is unconscionable. And Maduro's being propped up there by Cuba. His intelligence service is basically dominated by Cuban. The estimate is there's some 2 to 5,000 Cuban people in the intelligence area, but more importantly, in the ranks of advising the armed forces there. And the corruption levels within the government on drug trading and everything else is just tremendous. And there's sort of this unholy alliance that you see between Putin, Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. And I think it's something of great concern because it's our own hemisphere. I mean, we spent a lot of time talking about the Middle East and talking about Korea, China, and stuff. And we have a tendency in this country to underestimate the importance of Latin America. And one of the things which I think most people didn't dream would happen, and certainly Maduro didn't, is basically every country, every democracy in Latin America has now condemned Maduro and said his last election was illegal, which it was. And the president of the National Assembly, Guaido, has declared himself to be president. And I think it was a very correct step of the Trump administration to recognize him immediately. Vice President Pence is involved in this, Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio particularly, I think, on the humanitarian side. And so this is something that people don't really understand that's going on in their own hemisphere. But the leaders of the hemisphere now are united, except for those countries I mentioned, which are dictatorships, in condemning this. The question is what this group, the Lima group, is going to do. The good news in Latin America is that Bolsonaro won the election in a runaway election, and he's put into power an economic team that could really drive that economy after it went into the worst recession in the history of Brazil, with a Chicago trained economist, Paulo Guedes, and Sergio Moro, who was the one who uncovered, you know, all of the Odebrecht, which somewhere between 800, the amounts are just staggering, that the corruption levels that were there, even into the 800 billions of dollars that were put through, and he's the one who had the courage to the judge to go against them, and he is now the Minister of Justice. So I think what we're going to see is a resurgent Brazil. I think a Brazil that will ally itself with the United States, and in particularly they have the largest army in Latin America, and they are very concerned with what's going on in Venezuela. So these are great areas of tension, but I think the United States and the administration is taking the proper leadership here on that area. And by the way, I had two op-eds, one that came out in Reuters about culture and conduct in the banking system, which I referred to. The other is the one that Christine and I collaborated on what's going on in the humanitarian situation, which I've left out there. So I think I covered all of the topics, Mr. Chairman, that you asked me to. So I'm happy to take questions on anything you want to ask me.
Before you go, I want to ask you one other question. And that is about Mexico, because we've talked about these other countries, and given the trading relationship we have with Mexico, where do you think that's going?
Well, López Obrador is an unusual person. I had a chance to host co-host an event at the American Society, where I'm chairman emeritus. I was chairman for a long time, about a year and a half ago. And basically what he was saying, and it was a small dinner, about 10 or 12 people, what he was saying there, he's basically started to impose in the sense of cutting off all new oil contracts, which the country needs, because he thought the last administration, Peña Nieto, was very corrupt. And, of course, what we're seeing on the drug trade and all this information coming out with El Chapo, there's a good chance that that was the case, and which I think is a mistake, because I think they need the foreign investment in the technology to develop their oil system. On the social side, and against the crime, what's he going to do against the crime situation? Because security is a major issue in Mexico, without a doubt, with the cartels and just in general. And it's sort of not clear. I think he doesn't want a problem with the United States. He likes to talk about what the great dictator of before the revolution in Mexico, Porfirio Diaz, used to say, so close to the United States and so far from God, vis-a-vis describing Mexico. So he doesn't want a problem with the United States, and he basically is cooperating on border situations with the administration. There's no doubt about that, but he's kind of a throwback in many ways to the old pre-party, although he broke away from pre. And we'll have to watch what the economy does. The other thing is internationally, he's reverted to this point of having a more independent, less aligned with the United States foreign policy. And so he has not recognized the National Assembly leader and still recognizes Maduro. In fact, he's offered to try and host a conference to mediate. The last two conferences, the Pope mediated and got nowhere. So I think Mexico is a situation that you have to take a look at. They've made a lot of reforms over the years in the financial situation, in their economy. They have a great central bank. There are a lot of positive things about Mexico, but it's still not clear where López Obrador, Almo as he's called, is going to take the country. It's still a work in progress. He's just at the beginning. We'll have to see. But I think he will be cooperative on the immigration situation. I think he will be cooperative on the drug situation with the United States.
It's a tough place. Why don't we let some of our... You covered a lot of ground, and I won't start with my questions. Let's start with yours.
One quick question, Bill, on China. I remember some 25 years ago, you were one of the few advisors to China. In fact, you were an advisor to Xu Guangli, the mayor of Shanghai. And Xu was building Pudong at the time, and you advised him to build a great park. You cited Hyde Park, Central Park. And the following year, you came back, and Xu said, let's go out for lunch to the park. And you went there, and it was one city block in total. And he just didn't get it. Do you think some of that exists today in China with the Chinese leaders, that they think a lot differently than we do, and which could lead to some surprises down the road?
I particularly, what's the question, David?
Do you think that the Chinese leadership thinks somewhat differently than we do, and that difference of view can lead to some serious problems down the road?
That they don't understand their own problems the way we do.
Yeah, well, I think that, again, you have this pull between the reformers or not. And remember, they have a real problem with their contamination of the air, the water, the food. And that's one thing that this regime has got to speak to because of the middle class being there. So I think, in a sense, we're at a turning point for with all these issues, whether it be the climate, the economic issues, their expansionary thoughts, both military and otherwise, is the sense of which road they're going to go. And so I think they're at a turning point in China. And it's not clear which road they're going to go, because I think if they do not open up properly, you could see a major problem economically in China. And they are spending a lot on so-called defense, on military spending. And that's another challenge, which the vice president pointed out, that we have. So I think we have a turning point here as to how this is going to work. And, of course, the Chinese basically historically and the Russians don't like each other, because the Chinese think that under the Qing dynasty, the Russians stole Siberia. And they've never forgotten that. And on the other hand, I once had Mayor Luchkov of Moscow, who was a Putin buddy, tell me, Bill, the United States and Russia ought to unite against the Chinese, because they're going to engulf the world. I looked at him and I said, Mayor Luchkov, the Chinese think you stole Siberia from them. And that's why Mao and Stalin basically disliked each other. And so I think this alliance between Putin and Xi Jinping is a very cynical alliance, which is basically put together to oppose the United States. And so I think it's something that we've got to be very careful about. Because remember, at the end of George Bush Sr. as president, we were the dominant power economically, the dominant power financially, and militarily in the world. And somehow, the way things unfolded over time, Mr. Putin has managed to take Russia partially back, although the economy is not doing well because of the high price of oil and gas, and we have what's going on in China. So I think the vice president's speech was kind of speaking to that. So I think it's a very challenging period as to what's going to happen with that relationship. Not only it's the U.S.-China relationship, but it's a relationship between Russia and China, because if you take a look at Central Asia, and this used to be the great game between Russia and the U.K. in the 19th century with India, the great game to me today is who's going to control all those oil resources and mineral resources in Central Asia. Is it going to be Mr. Putin, or is it going to be the Chinese with their One Belt, One Road? So I see problems coming up in that area.
That reminds me, one thing you didn't talk about, which is the country that may be even very soon more populous than China, and that is India. What do you think is happening there?
Well, I think you have a very strong leader in Modi. As you know, elections are coming up. He ran on a program of, turning the country around economically. There's been some success, some reform, but India needs a lot more. And, of course, you have this tremendous tension on the border between India and China. I think the Indians are very concerned about that. in the sense of trying to build up their own armed forces. And the question is, what role is United States-Indian relations going to take? And I think it's very important because, remember, under Nehru and his successors, the whole family, they were very much aligned with the Russians all during that period, and we got ourselves aligned with Pakistan, et cetera. It's kind of reversed now because the Chinese and the Pakistanis are basically together, and we're trying to build up a relationship with India. But I think it's a very good question because India has a potential to be an economic powerhouse, without a doubt. But they got to continue the reforms. And they are an offset. I think Japan and India are an offset, Australia, to what to the ambitions of China strategically and militarily.
We have a number of our colleagues that are doing work on the U.S.-India Security Alliance and then a more robust regional alliance. It's still work in progress. Part of the same question you raised with China and other parts of the world is the cohesion of the Indian nation.
I think that's a big problem, and I haven't spent the time in India that I have in China. For the last 30 years, I've been 80, 90 times there. I know Christina had been working with Doctors Without Borders and the CDC. She spent a lot of time in India. I really have not. I've been there a number of times, but I don't know India as well. But there's no doubt that Modi won that election on turning around that terrible bureaucracy that the English left them. And I think one of the things that will go down in history is what a terrible job Lord Mountbatten did on partitioning India. He had an extra year to do it, and he just seemed to want to get home. And one of the most disastrous, I think, elements of if you want to call it the fall or the dissembling of the British Empire, was what they did in India. I mean, they created a monster in the sense which then you had Bangladesh break off, et cetera. And to this day, the tension between the Hindus and the Muslims still exists. And so I think that's a real challenge for someone who's a nationalist, a Hindu nationalist like Modi, to try and bring the country together. Because there's no doubt that India is going to be butting heads with China, not only on the frontier, but also strategically and militarily.
Ed, you had a question.
Getting into China's internal politics, which after all will determine how they relate to us, Xi is the first president not to be selected by Deng Xiaoping. He has changed his policies, obviously, drastically. He has problems with the reformers. Deng Pufeng has come out with a speech saying basically he's not following Deng's policies. How important is the military in all this and its support for Xi and his remaining with the powers that he has?
Well, he's done a lot to court the military. You know, his wife was the highest-ranking female officer. She was a major general. She was actually an entertainer, but she was a major general in the People's National Army. And he's done a lot to do that, to court and reinforce the armed forces. One of the things he's emphasizing more, and it's a great question, Ed, is that he's putting more importance on the political commissar, the Communist Party indoctrination within the military, which had started to, you know, move away, just like it has on the corporations. The party secretary suddenly in every company has more importance than he did 10, 15 years ago. And some people compare it to going back to the days of Mao. So he's done a lot to try and court the military because he knows the importance of where the military is. Remember, he eliminated a couple of his people who are now in prison early on who had ties to the military. The example is Bo Xilai. Bo Xilai had been mayor of Dalian, turned Dalian around, and then was commerce secretary where I got to know him. And then he became mayor of the largest, of the province of Sichuan province, and which has the largest city in the world, Chongqing, which is 35 million people or 40 million people. And he was a great contender. And there are a number of so-called China experts that thought that Bo Xilai would win. Ed knows what I'm talking about. So the first thing that Xi Jinping did, the first thing he did when, in the leadership, was to eliminate Bo Xilai, who is now in prison for life, because Bo Xilai's father was a favorite general under Mao, and the loyalty of the Fourth Army was always supposed to be to Bo Xilai's father, which he cultivated, which was in Sichuan province. So I think that you're dealing with one of the shrewdest leaders today, in my humble opinion, that China has seen in a long, long time. I got to know him when he was down in Hangzhou, and people didn't give him a chance when he was party secretary there. This is 15 years ago. No one thought that he would ever rise to be president of China. But he is one tough, shrewd person. And I'm joined in that feeling by a number of people who know China very well. I think Henry Kissinger is one. And Lee Kuan Yew felt that way also about it. So you're dealing with someone that we haven't seen in China. Maybe even Deng Xiaoping. You have to go back almost to Mao, because if you want to be somewhat favorable, optimistic, you can say that Xi Jinping is a combination of Deng Xiaoping and Mao Zedong. Deng Xiaoping in the sense of the reformer cleaning up the economy, and Mao having the party control everything. And so I think it's a story that tends to be underestimated here, because we're looking strictly, you read the newspapers every day, I picked up the papers today, and all it is on trade, 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 trade. And they don't understand the wider implications, which Vice President Pence was trying to get at, in that speech he gave it to Hudson Institute, which I think was a landmark speech.
Sir.
I think one of the long-term goals of China is to have the yuan as a co-reserve currency with the dollar. On the one hand, China has a debt GDP of 300%. On the other hand, they've been accumulating physical gold, rumored to have as much as 20,000 tons. By the way, Fort Knox hasn't been audited since 1953. What are your thoughts on the yuan as a challenge to the dollar?
Well, there's no doubt that the RMB, as I call it, has been pushed to be an international currency, and the Chinese were able to convince the IMF to basically name it a reserve currency. A lot of people criticized the International Monetary Fund, and they thought a lot of politics was in there with Christine Lagarde getting reelected and one thing or another. And, of course, they did a deal with Osborne under the Cameron government to give it a special status in the U.K. as part of their trying to woo China. I think they're still a long way from challenging the dollar, but you're right about the gold reserves being built up. But you know who else is doing that? Putin. He's getting rid of his dollars as fast as he can and buying gold. And you're seeing that in a number of countries led by Russia, China. But I think the dollar is still supreme in international transactions, but there's no doubt that the Chinese have that in mind. People tend to forget that in the 1920s and 30s, before Japan invaded China, that the financial center of Asia wasn't in Tokyo. The financial center of Asia was in Shanghai. The metals markets of the world were in Shanghai. And so the Chinese have never forgotten that they were the center of finance. I mean, Hong Kong was like an unknown English, port tributary, really, in the 20s and 30s. In fact, Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, which was the big bank in Hong Kong, didn't have its headquarters in Hong Kong, and its headquarters in Shanghai. And they still look back to those days. And so they still see them, they want themselves to be the dominant financial force in Asia And I think they will continue to push to do that. But in order for them to do that, they got to make sure that they don't ruin the economy, because if they don't take the financial steps on reform, that ain't going to happen. But that is a long-term goal. You're absolutely correct.
Questions? Yeah, Mark.
Going back to the Mike Pence linkage of all these different elements of China, and then looking at this trade conversation, do you think the administration is willing to accept a trade deal unlinked to some of these other things? Or are they trying to link IP, link stealing, link cyber, link the South China Sea to trade? Because that's where we have leverage in trade.
Well, I haven't had a chance to sit down and talk to Lighthizer. I did have a chance, without mentioning the name of which member of the cabinet, but I had a chance to talk on a couple of occasions with this particular member of the cabinet who's involved in this. And he basically says, he said, look, Bill, we understand that we've got to basically build in enforcement here. And because I said to him, you know, I think the biggest challenge is intellectual property. He said, absolutely, Bill. But he said, the other one is enforcement. And he said, we are going to insist on some sort of enforcement mechanism. And that is easier said than done. And I think that some of the things that are being discussed, the hardcore issues now, are those, actually. So although the Chinese want this deal, they need this deal, how they're going to handle 2025 intellectual property and enforcement is going to be the real key. And I think the United States got to hold the line. And I was when I was in Europe a few months ago, I had one of the leading financial statesmen, who's a good friend of mine, of Europe, told me, he says, you know, Bill, he's French, and he said, you know, Bill, people think all sorts of bad things about the way our, you know, President Trump says this and that and everything else, but I tell you, in Europe, he has 100% support for what's going on in China. I think the only problem was, I think that the Europeans and the United States would have linked up more in facing off on China. And I think that's something that needs to be done, because they are very supportive of what is going on in these negotiations, without a doubt, because they realized, I mean, the Germans are finally coming to their senses on this. Also, I think the French. But you have to remember that through the China Development Bank and the China Exim and the major Chinese state-owned banks, they're putting out trillions of dollars in, you know, in aid, you know, tied into their construction companies, to their paths along here. And so that's buying up a lot of these countries. And what these countries don't understand is all it's doing is, like when I was called into by Paul Volcker and the Secretary of the Treasury to restructure the Latin American debt, is all they're doing is building up a lot of debt. And how are they going to repay that debt? Which is one of the points I think the administration's making. It's our Secretary of State is on a world tour talking about that, and I think that's absolutely correct. So,
last question.
What would you comment on the power relations between North Korea and the United States and China? And are we somehow and naively getting involved in helping North Korea with their economy, which will eventually phase in with that of China, and add a third country against us with China?
Well, I restructured the Korean debt. I led the discussions from the private sector on the Corus FTA, and I spent a lot of years dealing with Korea. Of course, we have the head of the Korea Society here, who's an expert on this and travels more, you know, more often now than I do to Korea. But I think your question is a very good one, because I think the president's got to be very careful that that there is a plan of enforcement there on denuclearizing North Korea, and I think that you have a president of South Korea, Moon Jae-in, who is so dedicated to getting a deal that I think he'll go overboard to get it. And the Chinese play a role in there for obvious reasons. Just look back at the time of the Korean War. General MacArthur's great mistake in his career. He misunderstood that the Chinese were going to go put 2 million men over the Yalu River. And so I think that China and the U.S. could do something on Korea, but you have this fellow, as I said, who's like his grandfather, Kim Il-sung, who has a great ability to play one against the other. I think we have to be very careful there with North Korea, because obviously they have the nuclear capacity, we know. They have the missile technology up to a certain point. The Japanese are scared like heck that the United States is going to give in, because they're going to be the first recipient, Japan, of anything that Korea might do, North Korea. I think it's very, very difficult situation, and I think and hope that the president is very careful in his dealings with this guy, because he's a very shrewd operator. He's a guy that if you're not careful, he'll take you to the cleaners and take your watch and wallet right away from you. So I think we have to be very careful on North Korea.
And I need to be very careful now and be mindful of the time. We promised to get you all out by 1:45. So I'm Sarah Stern. I'm chairman of the board of Hudson. And I want to thank you, Bill, for an incredible tour de monde, tour de force. We incredible. I think most of us would rather spend the afternoon listening to you than get back to our offices, but this is what we do at Hudson. Incredible insight, incredible knowledge. If you were coming in here looking for some glimpses of warmth on this icy day, we didn't get too many of them. But I did. I think there were a few rays. I think there was some hope in there somewhere.
Brazil and the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely, the strength of the U.S. And I think that that, again, is what we look for at Hudson. We need clear-eyed analysis. We need to understand threats before we can recommend solutions. And in order to do that, we need dollars to pay people's salaries. So I thank all you members of the Chairman's Advisory Board who provide those dollars to help us do what we need. And for those of you who are just tasting us today, think about what delicious food we can give, just not just morsels. So I don't know, Bill, if you have to rush back to somewhere, because I know there are a lot more questions. If you're going to stay for a few minutes, people may appreciate it. If you have to go think deep thoughts, go ahead. Thank you, everybody, for coming. We appreciate your support, and mainly we appreciate your thoughts and wisdom.
Well, I think thank you, and I appreciate all of you who turned out in this snowstorm, because I didn't think anyone was going to be here, so I appreciate it. So
thank you, Bill.